This is Future of Water, where we talk about all the ways which companies, utilities, and people are addressing the challenges and opportunities in water. Today, it's all about infrastructure and what the recently signed bill means for water going forward. So to do so, joined today by John Berryman and Greg Goodwin to kick some ideas around. Actually, John is going to lead the conversation and Greg and I are going to answer some calls or questions, should I say, around the proverbial water cooler and what we're thinking. But before we do that, let's just give you a couple news headlines for the week. Gradient, an on-site industrial water treatment solutions provider, project developer, announced about $100 million in Series C funding. The round was led by Warburg Pincus and Schlumberger New Energy. This round brings Gradient's total funding to about $200 million since its inception. We at Bluefield have been interested watchers in Gradient and what they've been up to. One, because they're Boston-based and we're always curious about that, somewhat selfishly. But also it focuses on industrial with footprint in Asia as well. I mean, in recent years, it built out Asia footprint, or at least bolstered its footprint in the region through acquisitions of Sigma Water out of Malaysia and CRS Water in Australia. So we look forward to seeing the growth of that company and how it transitions going forward with a little bit more capital under its belt. Secondly, and the last news item of the day, that is AECOM has launched Digital AECOM to help clients accelerate their digital positions. So this strategy seems to be following two paths. One is just digital consulting services through its existing business and roster of experts around the world, but also it's launching a digital product strategy as well. The latter, digital projects or products, should I say, will include its Plan Engage product that focuses on stakeholder engagement and planning processes to help clients. And then the second product, notably, is Plan Spin, that's really focused on capital planning. It's a capital planning platform for customers and clients. Why do we care about this? Well, one, given the role of the EPCs as gatekeepers of sorts in the municipal and industrial sectors, for that matter, to capital and operating investment decisions, this is just another important player moving into the digital solutions and product arena. We've been mapping the players, the EPCs specifically, in their standalone reports, who's doing what, how they're doing it, because not every strategy is the same. Some are technology agnostic, some are trying to develop their own products, some are partnering with key vendors in certain ways, and some are more active through M&A than others. So this is really in Bluefield's wheelhouse and in our research wheelhouse. So if you're looking to learn more about this, you can always reach out to us. This is another step in what we would call the digitization of the water sector. So that being said, I'm going to pass it off to John Berryman, and let's have a conversation with John and Greg Goodwin.
All right. For those not used to my voice, I'm John Berryman, Director of Sales at Bluefield Research. We are changing it up a bit, as I've had a number of clients come our way looking for insights in the last, I'd say 10 days or so, into the infrastructure bill and its impact on water. So we wanted to flip the tables a little bit. I'm joined today by Reese Tisdale and Greg Goodwin to discuss their perspectives on this infrastructure bill. So let's jump on in and talk about what this all means. Greg, I'm going to punt it to you to start us off. Can you give us a breakdown of the bill and kind of where this water fits into it all?
Sure. Thanks, John. So just kind of high level items. It's $1.2 trillion overall in terms of the dollar figure for the bill, and about $550 million of that is going to be new spending. When we're talking about water infrastructure related spending, that's about $55 billion of that is going to be going towards, you know, different various water programs. So the largest of that will be the combined state revolving fund, clean water, drinking water program, which is the largest line item. But interesting to see that there are pretty large outlays both for addressing lead service lines across the country and for PFAS remediation, two items that have gotten a lot of news stories over the last year and beyond. So that's an interesting development that we're seeing within there. A key part of this is that funding takes place over a five-year period, which kind of starts to eliminate some of the risk of having shovel-ready projects that zero in on the need. And then there's also kind of an equity component to the bill as well. There's a clear focus on lower income communities and rural areas that are in need of not only infrastructure upgrades, but some basic infrastructure like broadband connectivity. And obviously kind of the lead pipe situation is one that disproportionately affects lower income communities.
Yeah, I think I'll add to that, Greg. I think that's useful because, you know, I mean, to start out with, I would say that this bill in its current state as signed, it's not for water specifically, it's not really all that different from what it was in sort of in the planning process when we last looked at it in great detail in August. We'd done some analysis looking at the three different bills making their way through Congress and, you know, from, you know, what, $2 or $3 billion in total and what that meant for water versus in this case 1.2. I think the one thing that's interesting about this is, relatively speaking, this is it the first time it seems like in my lifetime, but I would say that water infrastructure for stimulus, it's getting 10% of the new funding, which is $55 billion. That's pretty significant. You know, when you look at roads and bridges, they're getting $110 billion. The power and the grid, they're getting, you know, around $65 billion. So of the new funding, so that's 12%. So in this case, water infrastructure is closer to the power and grid and passenger and freight rail and broadband, which are other big ticket items on the list. So I think everybody should be pretty excited about that. There are some disappointments. One, that the lead problem is not new. I think, Greg, you probably remember this better than I do. What is it, 1986 is when we said we were going to get lead out of the pipes or off the premises. I think that's what the terminology is. So that's been around for a long time, and it's taken this long to get there. I think the other thing I would add is that, to your point, the PFAS mitigation, you know, that's still there. I mean, I think before the pandemic, as I've mentioned before, that there was a lot of discussion about, you know, PFAS. Lead was, I don't want to say, it was somewhat on the back burner, quite honestly. I mean, with a few exceptions and things like what was happening in Pittsburgh or Flint and other Newark, other places. But, you know, PFAS is still getting a big chunk of the change on top of, you know, the state revolving fund dollars as well.
Yeah, I think that's right in terms, Reese, of the magnitude of the spend that's going to be directed towards water infrastructure. You know, we took a look back towards, you know, kind of a larger historical view, went back about 50 years to really the beginning of the creation of the EPA and the Clean Water Act in 1970 and 1972, respectively. And in terms of the amount of federal appropriations that will be directed towards water infrastructure in the next 5 years in inflation-adjusted terms, it's the highest it's been since around the late 70s, when there was a large effort to try to get, you know, wastewater treatment plants up to snuff to fit sort of the Clean Water Act, with the one-year exception of sort of the ARRA stimulus bill in 2009 to fit the Great Recession, which is a tiny spike kind of in that line that we see was a little bit higher than it's going to be for this particular bill. But as we mentioned before, this is a five-year program right now, so certainly different in that respect and more impactful over that period. So it's definitely a big deal for the water industry at large.
Yeah, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here. I think also what's interesting is, all right, $55 billion is dedicated to water, but when you start looking at things like broadband or the power in the grid or roads and bridges, you know, they're actually, depending on where you are in the value chain of the water sector, if you're a vendor selling, you know, pipes, culverts, storm drains, you know, for every road that's built, you got to have storm drains. You got to have, there need to be culverts. So in some cases, hydrants. I mean, there's more that needs to be added to that as well. So there, and I think, Greg, you and I talked about it the other day, all broadband. So if we're going to be laying cable from, you know, here to San Francisco across the Midwest to rural areas, well, chemical companies have to make more wire to do that. I mean, so there's, and so therefore the industrial process becomes, water is part of that process, and therefore it has to be managed there as well. So there's more upside than just the $55 billion overall. So I think that's a little harder to put your finger on, but I would say, you know, rising tide lifts all boats in this case. So I think the water industry as a whole should take this as a great opportunity. There are some gaps we can get into in a little bit, but I'm excited about that.
So just to sum it up, this is a multi-decade long issue that we are now finally throwing some real money at and addressing. And on the water side, this is a huge deal. So Greg, I want to give it back over to you for a minute. What does it actually mean for water? Like, how is it going to be spent? How do we break up this $55 billion spend?
Sure. As I mentioned before, sort of the state revolving fund program on both the clean water and drinking water side is going to be where the largest sort of dollar figures are going to be dedicated to. So between 2022 and 2026, there's going to be about $29 billion combined between those two programs, and it steps up incrementally during those years. So for example, in 2022, there's set to be $4.8 billion of federal money given to the program, and that's going to step up to 5.4, and then 6, and then 6.4 towards the end of the program, or the end of the bill, the bill's passage, if you will. So, that's kind of the main avenue for a lot of the projects that the capital projects that we see out in the marketplace. So there's going to be a fair amount of more money in those buckets than has previously been in recent years. And at least in the short term, there's also going to be sort of a simplification, if you will, of some of the applications process to kind of get some of those projects moving. So some of the qualifiers that municipalities are going to need to go through are going to be a little bit reduced for a period. And then kind of getting into more sort of dedicated items, there's $15 billion specifically earmarked for the lead removal program. This is lower than, our estimates of over $30 billion, but I mean, you have to start somewhere. And this is a significant investment in putting some real effort into that problem. So there's an emerging contaminants and sort of really kind of PFAS is really the kind of the, I get most well known within that bucket of sort of water issues. There's $10 billion that's going to be dedicated to remediating emerging contaminants and PFAS. And this is, across from, everything from kind of studying the problem in greater detail to really sort of that on the ground remediation at the plant level and beyond to remove it from the drinking water sphere. But then some of the smaller line items, but still significant, are the WIFIA program, which is a newer program, I think started in 2016 for financing newer projects, is going to get $250 million. Over the next 5 years. There's also $1 billion that's going to be dedicated towards water reuse, something we've talked about recently here at Bluefield, specifically dedicated kind of west of the Mississippi through the Bureau of Reclamation. So that's going to be about $200 million a year over the next 5 years dedicated towards addressing that issue. And then there's a host of sort of smaller programs around efficiency, connecting rural areas from septic to POTWs that are all going to get, in the hundreds of millions of dollars kind of range over the 5 year period. So it's diverse in sort of its aims, but all the programs that are used right now for the types of projects we see here at Bluefield are going to be, getting a pretty significant injection of cash.
Thanks, Greg. So you explained the breakdown of those numbers, but Reese, do you have anything to add just in general, kind of higher level?
Yeah, I would say, I think to Greg's point, one thing is it seems the bigger story is there's an effort to target or support, for lack of a better way to put it, financially constrained communities, right? Whether it be lower income or just less technology sophisticated. I don't know of another way to put it, but so basically there are loans and grants. So I think the total dollars. I think at least a minimum of 10% need to be, and a max of from 10 to 30% need to be, you know, loan or grant funded. What they've also done is, for the states, lowered the matching contribution, which they've historically would set at 20% for state revolving funds. So they've lowered that, I believe, Greg, to 10%, if I remember correctly, with looking at all these numbers. But I think, you know, the big picture is the state revolving funds, it really is a great channel to market. I think it's really important to understand that. It's not just for utilities to understand. I think the vendor and solutions provider, that end of the, once again, the value chain, they need to understand that, because there are, particularly when you get into smaller, medium-sized utilities or system owners, they don't want, they may not have the resources, they may not have the time. So any guidance they can get to secure project financing is really what we're talking about here. Loans or grants need to be, you know, there's a process, right? And so if vendors can help organizations do that and walk them through it, that's a benefit, I think, to everybody, right? Not only the end customer, user, the utility, but also to the vendor. I think the other thing is that it's well established, the SRF program. I mean, to put things in perspective, take a look at SRF projects every year. So last year, we looked at, the number sticks out in my mind, 12,012 projects that requested funding through the state revolving fund last year. And I think the total was about $94 billion of requests. Now, of that, the awards totaled only 15 to 20 billion, if my memory serves me correctly. So there's a huge gap between requests and awards, right? So I think this, in the short term, over the next 5 years, this maybe closes that gap. I think the other thing is, because it's a five-year program, this hopefully allows utilities and states to also kind of think more strategically about what needs to be done, as opposed to, you know, what's shovel ready or what has to be done now. So it does give a little bit more flexibility there. So I think we're pretty excited about that. And lastly, I mean, I just to add on, you know, the big picture is, well, I would say, as I mentioned a little while ago, as far as gaps go, I mean, there is the BLM money, you know, for reuse, but there, and there's really nothing dedicated specifically to digital besides cybersecurity dollars, which is broader than just the water sector. But there's no reason that funds dedicated to things such as reuse and digital can't be secured through the state revolving fund as well. They just have to, you know, depends on where they match and where they sit or fall in the prioritization of the project. So it was expected that state revolving funds would get all the dollars. And in fact, even it's not just the $29 billion. I think even the other $10 and $15 billion will be funneled through there as well, because it's established. And it also delivers the dollars, or those dollars are being used or decided upon at a more local level, whether it be the state or local level, as opposed to some top-down federal, you know, EPA guidance. You've got to spend dollars on X, Y, and Z.
For anybody who is listening and maybe doesn't know, could either of you give us a little context on state revolving funds in general, when those became a thing? And then even just to kind of put into perspective, because I think it's hard for us to kind of conceptualize really large numbers. So give us an idea of just how much money $55 billion is, right, that's going into water. And then are there other examples of like allocated water amounts that have gone through state revolving funds in the past?
Yeah. So I can speak to that at least briefly. So to put it in perspective, in an annually, the water sector capital investments, hardware equipment spend, that's about a $50 billion a year market for the municipal water. So, you know, that's 1 year. Operating expenditures for water are closer to probably $65, $75 billion a year. So all in, we're talking, you know, $110, $120 billion a year that goes in just municipal water. That does not include industrial. The state revolving funds, that's a good question. I don't remember exactly when they came about, but Greg, maybe you know that. I don't remember offhand. Aaron Bonnie Casey would certainly know. But I think what they are is really, they're basically pools that the federal government puts, you know, several billion dollars a year into the pot. It is allocated by sort of clean water, drinking water needs surveys. So it's allocated, it's basically population based in many respects. So, you know, California obviously gets a big chunk of those dollars, as would Texas. They have larger populations in needs. And so what ends up happening is that the dollars are allocated proportionally across the U.S. And then the states, every program is a little bit different. It's broken up into drinking water and clean water, as I said. But states have had to match. And some states are more aggressive in how they award projects. Ohio sticks out in my mind. It's one we look at every year. If projects meet the criteria requested, they will fund all the projects that come through there. So they actually go beyond what the expected allocation is. That's one good thing. Whereas other states do not. And that is that I can't speak to explicitly to whether that's a function of just poor management on the state level or whether they're just not enough requests. My earlier comment about smaller systems, they have a tough time. You know, they've got enough things on their plate already, and this is just another thing they have to deal with. What they are is basically the federal government puts it in. They are primarily loans. And so all the money that comes back into the state pot, it stays in the state pot, and the state is able to work with that. So it is sort of an ongoing program to facilitate water and wastewater or drinking water and clean water infrastructure investment. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Greg.
Just a little bit of historical context. The system that that Reese is mentioning there in terms of through the state, I believe that modernized way of appropriating the funds started in around 1987. And then the program itself at large, I think, started around 1972. And from that 15-year period prior, the federal government would appropriate funds directly to municipalities. So they moved to more of a federal system after sort of the mid to late 80s into the modern system that you see now, where there's that kind of match that happens between the federal and state level, and it's managed more by the states. So there's just a little bit of extra background on how that came about. I think that's sort of the timeline for the program itself.
And significance there being it's not just a top-down directive, right? So it kind of allows the states to take that need-based approach, basically. State has their own issues that they're dealing with, so they can funds kind of at a more local level, right?
Exactly. Yeah, there's more of a kind of a layer of federalism in there, that of making control based on the state level rather than kind of between municipality and the federal government.
So I guess all of that being said, with this new bill being signed into place, can we point to any winners specifically and or losers at this point? What do you guys predict here?
Well, I'll jump in on that. I would say, as always, in the water sector, it seems, I think the big winners are engineering firms. They are known to be gatekeepers of sorts to particularly larger projects. So not only they help because they support, whether it be through consulting services, but also just in procurement, construction, they help guide utilities on decisions. They're more, say, aware of new innovations, new solutions. They've got boots on the ground across the U.S. or globally where they learn, whereas a utility team more often is sort of locked in on its own network and experiences. So they're winners. I think they're quite honestly winners of sort of any climate related investment, let alone just basic water infrastructure. I would also add, and Greg could probably speak more to this as well, and there's like, who's focused on lead? And I think Greg has actually done some research on this, looking at, first you have to inventory the problem, right? So who can do that, whether it be engineering firms or whether it be, I mean, there is an emerging group of digital, if you will, solutions providers that are finding ways to sort of identify where the lead problem is without breaking ground. So that's step one. And then, you know, the other part of that is who's going to do the replacement of the lead service lines. And those would be more local contractors, from whether it be state to state, region to region, city to city. I think there's big opportunity. And, you know, a lot of that, at least by our numbers, I think 10 states represent about 60 to 65% of the opportunity or problem, depending on your perspective. So if you're in the mid-Atlantic to the Midwest, sort of straight across from, you know, East Coast to Illinois, that's where a big chunk of the opportunity is going to be. That being said, there's opportunity everywhere. I mean, whether it be in Colorado or other states as well. And then lastly, you know, we haven't talked, as I mentioned, digital is not necessarily a line item, but cybersecurity is a big area of interest, you know, and it's with the digitization of just the economy as a whole, not just water, wastewater infrastructure. That's, you know, with that comes risks, and that would be cybersecurity. So that's a market that's gonna balloon, and those who have positions. I know a company like Tetra Tech, for instance, engineering firm. Once again, they've built out or at least acquired some cyber technology solutions as well. So companies like that, among others, will be well positioned. I don't know if you have anything to add, Greg.
I think I agree sort of with that layout of sort of the types of firms and entities. I guess one thing that I might add that we haven't discussed too much, but could be a factor is, you know, manufacturers and producers that have a large sort of US-based footprint in terms of where products and materials are sourced. There is a, you know, a domestic sourcing requirement within this bill. That's not really a new provision. Those things have been around since the 1930s and onward, but there definitely is sort of a larger political element within this bill to sort of call that out. So there are some potential provisions for, you know, certain types of materials. You know, typically it's been things like iron and steel that need to be sourced from the US, but within this bill is there's provisions for, you know, things based on glass, polymers, lumber, other types of sort of materials, and then also manufacturing components, a certain percentage, you know, having to be manufactured within the US to qualify for some of these contracts. So that's all to say that, you know, there's going to be some jockeying within the next 6 months to a year within, you know, executive agencies that are deciding what those definitions really are. And obviously people lobbying to be on the right side of that equation. But all to say just that there are firms that have a larger US presence will probably have an easier go of sort of being having access to this money. And it's an interesting kind of dynamic that we're going to see kind of develop over the next year or so and beyond. So just that's an interesting extra wrinkle to this this whole thing that I think we're going to probably see more about in the coming months and probably years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes also at an interesting time, Greg. I mean, I think that's a really good point. Because also there are all these supply chain constraints right now. And there's, you know, people are quite honestly not happy about their components and parts sitting in a, you know, on a ship off the coast of Long Beach, California, coming from China or other parts of Asia or other parts of the world. So whether that is played into that, you know, there is this, I think it's going to be quite honestly impossible to renationalize, you know, the US industry. I think that ship has sailed, no pun intended. But it'll be interesting. We're definitely going to hear from, you know, US based vendors like pushing, you know, is there going to be another wave of, you know, American made, right? I feel like that was a big thing for a while. Greg, you're old enough, you're closer to my age than others. And, I felt like we used to see a lot of that, you know, going to Walmart and places like that. And then it feels like it died down a little bit. Maybe we'll start seeing that again.
Yeah, I think there's, you can sort of sense at least a resurgence of that mentality. How it plays out, I think, will be interesting. It's, you know, obviously things only move forward in terms of a highly globalized sort of economy, but you can sort of see the political winds blowing that way, at least a little bit, in terms of how this bill was passed and how people want to position it in their districts and their states.
Yeah, I think, you know, and before, and because I know we're about to wrap up, it seems, one point I want to add, because I can't stop talking, and that is, one part of this, the broader bill, is there's a shift happening. Like, some of the energy provisions did make it into it, like whether it be electric vehicles and things like that. And so with that, that means, you know, at Bluefield, we do talk a fair amount about sort of the energy transition and the, what are the broader impacts, whether it be on the gas sector or oil and gas or coal for that matter. So thinking longer term, you know, if dollars are going towards this transition and sort of propping up, you know, it provides some pretty good tailwinds to that space, which means there's a big change for water. I mean, when we started looking at, when we launched Bluefield in 2013, there was all, you know, the shale gale, you know, was in full play. I mean, it was like, we're going to be swimming in natural gas. And that seems to be kind of transitioning a bit. You know, what's out there now is like greater focus on electric, greater focus, and now even hydrogen is coming on to the horizon as a potential opportunity for not only just power or battery storage, but also for transportation, right? And so if that in fact happens, then the water management profile changes across that whole landscape where, you know, the coal is not providing water to coal generated power. It's probably more going to clean up as we decommission these plants. Maybe, you know, gas plants, maybe only the most efficient remain. But then there's the hydrogen play as well. And then secondarily, there's always the talk of lithium mining and where's that going to happen? Is it going to happen, whether it be in North Carolina or Southern California or Chile and Argentina? So, you know, lithium mining for batteries requires water as well. And lastly, you know, renewables don't really require that much water, at least in the operating, at least in the generation process for power. The manufacturing is another matter. But I just want to throw that out there as maybe even a longer term play. When you look at the pie chart of opportunities for water management across the energy space.
Yeah, to bring this just back into the infrastructure bill, since that's our reason for discussion today and getting together. Bluefield, we have this kind of privileged position of being objective observers of the water space. And I kind of want to throw it to you guys one last question. In your conversations with the market, we're speaking with clients. Can you give us a temperature check? Are people excited overall? Are they frustrated because the numbers aren't big enough? Is it somewhere in between? What would you say?
Sure. So, I mean, I think it's still pretty early. I mean, obviously, you know, this was just officially passed this week in terms of the presidential signing. But I think we're seeing a lot of excitement. I mean, as I mentioned before, this is the most money that's getting thrown at water from the federal trough over a 5-year period in, you know, half a century almost, except for that one blip, really, that, you know, inflation adjusted about $8 billion in about 2009 or 10, whenever that stimulus bill passed. So I think there's a sense of opportunity for sure from some of the conversations that we're having on the part of, you know, EPC firms and vendors and so forth of, you know, lots of activity potentially in the next few years. I mean, after there is sort of the supply chain issue that Reese mentioned before and concerns over inflation and what might happen in the next year with sort of some of these contracts that are that are overrun or, you know, longer term than things that have been paid for but cannot you know, get going on the ground yet. So you know, foresee maybe kind of a hiccup over the next year or two, but certainly a sense of kind of optimism on the part of some of these providers that are really detailed at looking at some of these issues like lead and PFAS remediation, which we've, you know, been working on quite a bit over the last few years, that there's going to be, you know, this trough of money that's available to kind of address these problems. So, you know, from my perspective, I think things are looking pretty positive. There's a lot of activity and inquiry, and, you know, we expect it, I think, to only pick up from here now that this is really official.
And these are real dollars. It might not be quite enough to close the gap, but it's obviously $15 billion, $10 billion, that's nothing to shake your head at, right?
Yeah, I think so. I would agree with Greg. I think there's general optimism. I think if anything, we may have sort of become numb to it because the process, well, maybe, and maybe it's the right way things should be, is, you know, the overall $1.2 trillion, it took a while to work through the, to make the sausage, so to speak, in Congress. And, but the water part has been fairly consistent through that. So, you know, maybe we've become a little numb to that. I mean, if there's a complaint, it would be, you know, there are the inflation hawks out there, to Greg's point. And then there's also, well, what about technology? We're not putting enough money towards technology and solutions. But I guess to my point is that's not necessarily, that's not exactly the case, because state revolving funds are getting a big part of this. And so the question is, where are the solutions going? And or state revolving fund dollars going. And it's not to say that technologies can't be used for that. So newer, more innovative technologies. So yeah, I would say it's general optimism, you know, and I'd like to think that. I think, you know, sometimes you sort of talk yourself out of it and say, oh, you know, you can't live without water for more than 3 days. Why are we not spending enough? Why is, you know, roads and transportation getting $110 billion. Well, unfortunately, that's a bit of, that's kind of the plight of the water industry. It's sort of out of sight, out of mind. Everybody expects it. Everybody feels the potholes when they drive down the road or and they see the crappy bridges spanning the rivers, you know, across America. And so that's what politicians can stand in front of and say, I've made your life so much more comfortable because there are no potholes down, you know, Elm Street anymore. But in the case of water, it's out of sight, out of mind. But I think this is a big win. I'm excited about it. And there's going to be a flurry of activity. People are amped up about it. Everybody will eventually have to take a breath and start, you know, filing those applications for state revolving funds. Let's make it happen.
Great. Guys, thanks a lot for all the insights. And for those listening, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for topics for us to discuss, you can always let us know at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com. Thanks, Reese. Thanks, Greg.
All right, John. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
All right. That was John Berryman, Greg Goodwin, and myself. So thanks a million. Before we sign off, please subscribe and give the podcast Future of Water a review. Send us a note, as John said, at waterexperts@bluefieldresearch.com with any topics or ideas you want us to discuss. And as always, tell a friend about it. We want more listeners. It helps us help you. This podcast and these water industry insights have been brought to you by the one and only Bluefield Research. To learn more about us, bluefieldresearch.com is where you can find us. Take care, be well, be safe. Talk soon.